Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
We meet at a moment of great peril in the region. Iran and its militant partners, including Hamas, have driven us to the precipice of a broader conflict.
In an attempt to avoid that broader conflict, the United States and the UK are targeting Iran, hitting the regime with new sanctions over its attack on Israel last weekend, hoping allies, including Canada, do the same, and hoping a diplomatic response is enough for Israel, which isn't ruling out something more aggressive. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Susan Bonner. It is Thursday, April 18th, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern, also on the podcast.
It can't get any bigger. It is the biggest management event of any kind in the world. Mind-boggling.
India is about to hold the largest general election ever. It will take weeks, with nearly a billion registered voters, more than a million polling stations, and the focus is on one man. And in this country, the way we screen for cancer is under the microscope. A group of experts say Canadian guidelines are out of date and lives are at risk. It's a move to both punish and deter. 5 days after launching missiles and drones into Israel, Iran is being slapped with sanctions by the U.S. and the U.K. The measures are also a message. The West has Israel's back. The question now, will it be enough to stop the escalation of the crisis in a region already on edge? Sasha Petrasek reports from Washington.
To see the parade in Tehran this week, you might think Iran just scored a huge military success. Marching bands and drones on display, even if most of the ones launched at Israel never hit their targets. It was for show. Past Western sanctions against Iran have also seemed mostly for show, unable to prevent Tehran from selling its oil or building a huge squadron of drones.
In response, the United States announced sanctions this morning.
Today, Washington announced more through its deputy ambassador to the United Nations, Robert Wood.
And we will continue to disrupt the networks that support Iran's reckless proliferation of weapons.
The U.S. is naming 16 Iranian officials and two entities involved in making drones. It's also restricting the movement of Iranian diplomats at the U.N. in New York. Even its foreign minister can't go farther than two blocks. He was at the U.N. to justify Iran's actions because of Israel's earlier airstrike on Iran's consulate in Damascus. Britain and European countries also vowed new sanctions. A group of seven ministers meeting in Italy, including Canada, promised close coordination. British Foreign Minister David Cameron.
Not just because of what Iran has been doing, but also as a message to Israel that we want to play our part in having a coordinated strategy that deals with Iran's aggression.
Joseph Borrell, the EU's head of diplomacy, says the threat of escalating conflict makes sanctions urgent.
We are on the edge of a war, a regional war in the Middle East, which will be sending shockwaves to the rest of the world, and in particular to Iran.
Will the new sanctions prevent that?
In reality, they are not doing anything.
Saeed Golkar, an Iranian who teaches at the University of Tennessee, doesn't think so. Partly, he says, because the measures are haphazard, and partly because the Iranian regime cares more about promoting its religious ideology.
Why you are doing that? It doesn't make sense from a rational point of view, but it makes sense from the ideology. And you are sacrificing everything else for this and for your ideology.
Today, Iran also threatened to turn its nascent nuclear program from a civilian one to a military one, if compelled to defend itself. something Golkar says it already is.
This is not a peaceful nuclear program because of many pieces of evidence that we have, because of the mentality of the Islamic Republic.
In a way, he says, Iran is celebrating not because it hurt Israel, but because it is supported by many Arabs as the only Mideast country which has militarily intervened during the Gaza conflict on the Palestinian side. Sasha Petrosik, CBC News, Washington.
The U.S. has vetoed a Palestinian request for full membership in the United Nations. 12 of the 15 Security Council members voted in favor of the motion. Britain and Switzerland abstained. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said it would be an important first step toward long-term peace in the Middle East. Israel was strongly opposed but does not have a vote on the Security Council. It was quite the up-and-down day at jury selection for Donald Trump's hush money trial. First, two jurors were dismissed. Now all 12 are confirmed, with alternatives still needed. And prosecutors are pushing to have Trump punished, accusing him of violating a gag order. Katie Simpson catches us up on the first few days in one of the most closely watched trials in American history.
On a rainy, windy New York City morning, Donald Trump arrived at a Manhattan courthouse for another long day of jury selection in his criminal hush money trial.
Mr. Trump, how are you doing this morning?
He ignored reporter questions as he headed into the room, where, over the course of a few hours, a full jury would be selected. But not before a few setbacks. Two jurors were excused unexpectedly. The first, a woman who feared being publicly identified. She told court her friends and colleagues reached out asking if she'd been picked based on how much is revealed about jurors, even though names are kept secret.
There is information in the juror questionnaire as they read their responses, like, what do they do for a living? Where do they work?
Jo Ellen Demetrius is an American jury consultant, and she says jurors have good reason to fear being identified, given the high profile and polarizing nature of this case.
The security concern is tremendous, and it's not just from the perspective of family and friends, but it's also from the perspective of individuals that are out there that, you know, may be a little bit imbalanced, that might try to come after the jurors after the fact.
After the woman was removed, Judge Juan Marchand ordered details about current and previous employers be kept secret. The reason for the second dismissal is less clear. The decision was made privately after concerns were raised about the man's past social media posts. As proceedings grind on, prosecutors appear to be growing frustrated with the defendant, accusing Trump of violating the gag order in this case 7 times since Monday alone.
Donald Trump was not supposed to attack the witnesses in the case, and he's done so consistently.
Nima Romani is a former federal prosecutor, and he says there's a decent chance Judge Marchand will agree that Trump violated the order. On social media, Trump has quoted conservative allies who claim the jury selection process is biased against him, and has attacked Michael Cohen, his former fixer, who is the star witness for prosecutors.
The judge can sanction Trump by fining him. That's what prosecutors are asking for. But the violations are intentional, and if they continue, then Trump can even be jailed.
Romani says he thinks it is extremely unlikely Trump would ever be jailed over a gag order violation, since it could trigger civil unrest. The issue will be dealt with next Tuesday. Judge Marchand has scheduled a hearing to address the gag order and hear arguments over potential violations. Trump's team denies wrongdoing. Katie Simpson, CBC News, Washington.
Coming up on the podcast, concerns over Canada's cancer screening protocol, outdated rules and inaccessible testing, plus the logistic and democratic challenges at play in India's election. A group of cancer doctors say Canadians' lives are at risk because family physicians are using outdated cancer screening guidelines. They say the national body that puts out guidelines has no expertise in screening for cancer and needs to be completely rebuilt. Marina von Stackelberg reports.
It's heartbreaking.
Anna Wilkinson is an Ottawa oncologist who treats women in their 40s dying of breast cancer.
I have women come in and they have metastatic breast cancer and they asked for a mammogram and they were told, no, you don't need one because you're in your 40s.
In her other job as a family doctor, her guidelines are to not send women that age for breast cancer screening. Those guidelines come from the Canadian Task Force on Preventative Healthcare. It's a federal arm's-length committee that recommends to family doctors when to send their patients for routine cancer screening. Wilkinson is part of a group of experts who say those guidelines are failing patients.
I think the national guidelines right now do not reflect the latest science, and I think they are harming Canadians because they are leading us to diagnose cancers at a later stage when we know survival is worse and when the costs of treatment are more.
The task force's current guideline on breast cancer screening is set to be updated next month. Right now, it still uses a study from the 1960s and says women in their 40s don't need a mammogram.
It was infuriating.
That meant Ottawa mom Carolyn Holland only found out she had advanced stage breast cancer 3 years ago when she felt a lump. At 43 years old, she'd never had a mammogram. Her diagnosis led to a double mastectomy and aggressive chemotherapy and radiation.
Knowing what I know from my doctors and knowing myself, had I been able to access screening at 40, this wouldn't have been my outcome.
Several provinces, including Ontario, have since gone against the National Task Force guidelines and started screening women her age. But it's not just those guidelines that have experts concerned. Many of the recommendations are a decade old and out of line with what other countries like Australia, the UK, and the US are doing. Canada's task force still recommends against screening for HPV and against a blood test for prostate cancer. Eddie Lang, a Calgary ER doctor and member of the task force, says his group does consider input from cancer experts.
As you can imagine, someone who's been researching and advocating in the breast cancer or prostate cancer field for their whole career might have a different view than a neutral group that is trying to make recommendations for family doctors.
Lang says the task force also needs to manage the harms of overdiagnosis. That's when someone has treatment for cancer that would never have caused them a problem.
What I would tell the task force, you're not saving us from harms, you're putting us in harm's way.
Cancer survivor Carolyn Holland says what she thinks about now is how many years she's lost off her life because her cancer wasn't caught sooner from a routine screening. Marina von Stackelberg, CBC News, Ottawa.
Another group fighting for better access to mammograms, people with accessibility issues. One Montreal advocacy group says nearly half of the clinics surveyed in the city can't accommodate someone using a wheelchair. As Allison Northcott tells us, it's a problem across the country, leaving many unable to get the potentially life-saving test.
You feel uncomfortable and you feel you're not welcome.
The last time Martha Tuibenire had a mammogram, she had to call three clinics to find one that would accommodate her wheelchair. In the living room of her apartment in Montreal, she recalls the appointment she did get and how it made her feel like she could never go back.
And they tried to call, can you stand up, madame? And I said, no, I have to sit in my wheelchair. They say, oh my God, what am I going to do?
The Coalition of Activists for Inclusion in Quebec, which advocates for people with disabilities, says stories like Tuibenire's are far too common. It surveyed nearly 100 Quebec clinics that offer mammograms and says nearly half said they couldn't do the scans for patients in wheelchairs.
We found that 43% of them are saying, no, we don't accept women in wheelchair.
Linda Gauthier, the group's co-founder, uses a wheelchair and says her last mammogram was a decade ago. She says the experience was so humiliating she hasn't had one since.
I felt like second-class citizen, even third-class citizen. I felt very bad.
The Office of Quebec's Health Minister says all women eligible for breast cancer screening must have access to a mammogram and says a reminder will be sent to all designated screening centres. Kirsten Sharp, a disability inclusion advocate in Vancouver who uses a wheelchair, says she's never had trouble getting a mammogram in BC, which offers a special mobile screening unit. But she says problems can persist and education is key.
I have had friends who called the exact same location that I went to and they were denied access. And it just depends on who answers the phone.
In New Brunswick, one group successfully lobbied the provincial government to improve access to the scans in hospitals.
Getting things like mammogram chairs and so.
Shelley Petit with the New Brunswick Coalition of Persons with Disabilities says the changes have convinced some who had avoided the procedure to make an appointment.
Because they went for the first time because of the chair, there was a small lump, but it was detected early enough and it was safe. So it's saving people's lives.
Because barriers to health care can have a ripple effect, says Agnès Berthelot-Raffard, associate professor of health policy at York University in Toronto.
A person living with disability could say, oh, generally, I do not have a good experience in this setting. So why I will have a better experience with another physician?
Tribanire knows she needs another mammogram again soon and hopes it won't leave her feeling as badly as the last one did. Alison Northcott, CBC News. Montreal.
The largest election in history begins tomorrow. Almost a billion people are registered to vote in India's general election. Thousands of candidates are running for more than 500 seats in Parliament. And as you might imagine, the voting process is no easy task. South Asia correspondent Salima Shivji is in Delhi with the details.
In a giant makeshift tent doubling as a dispatch center, hundreds of election officials wait for final instructions.
All our polling personnel is ready. They have been allotted to their respective polling station.
Some officials head high up in the hills of India's remote northeastern states, says District Election Officer Nazu Kumar. Others are wading through rivers and trekking for hours through jungle to set up polling booths. It's the eve of India's mammoth general election, a complicated democratic process that stretches over more than 6 weeks and 7 days of staggered voting.
It can't get any bigger.
S.Y. Qureshi used to run the whole operation as a former head of India's Election Commission.
It is the biggest management event of any kind in the world. The logistics are mind-boggling.
1 million polling stations, manned by some 15 million civil servants and protected by tens of thousands of paramilitary forces to ensure there's no violence. A massive enterprise, and yet the focus of this election is mostly one man. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. For his supporters waiting hours to see him at a rally, there's no question the 73-year-old, in power for a decade already, will win a third term. They adore him.
He is selfless, selfless. He works only for the people, so we are devoted to him.
I trust Modi, I vote Modi, like to develop our India, Modi's needed.
She points to a new temple in the holy city of Ayodhya in honor of the Hindu god Lord Ram.
Ram Mandir, it's a very big thing.
Built on the ruins of a demolished mosque, a long-standing promise of Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, fulfilled in January. It's one of the most concrete recent examples of India's shift towards Hindu dominance under Modi, at the expense, critics say, of India's minorities, particularly its 200 million Muslims. That shift is also why analysts believe this election is Modi's to lose, says Delhi-based political commentator Arti Jara.
The BJP's main appeal lies in that outreach to that Hindu nationalist sentiment, that we are the Hindu party, we are your party.
While Indian elections can pack surprises, opinion polls suggest Modi's popularity dwarfs that of his closest rival, Rahul Gandhi. Heir to a political dynasty and a senior leader with the Indian National Congress. Congress is part of an alliance of opposition parties hoping to unseat Modi. It will have 6 weeks to try. Voting begins Friday and will wrap up in early June, when the hundreds of millions of votes will be tallied all in one day. Salima Shivji, CBC News, Delhi.
Africa contributes a minuscule amount of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, but more and more the continent is feeling the worst of climate change. In West Africa's Sahel region, a major heat wave is underway, and a new report says there's no doubt it's influenced by human-caused global warming. Anand Ram takes us through the findings.
In a hospital bed in Niamey, Niger, an old woman lies tired, two plastic water bottles on her lap, and above, water drips down from a glass intravenous bottle into her arm. Her daughter says she's here because of the extreme heat. Doctors saying she was missing about 4 liters of water from her body. More and more elderly people are ending up in the hospital with dehydration, says Dr. Andia Abdul Kader. all from the intensity of that early April heat wave across Central and West Africa. Now it's being blamed on climate change, according to scientists who estimate the likelihood of recent extreme weather events to global warming. Claire Barnes is one of the report authors.
Without human-induced global warming, these temperatures wouldn't have been possible. So in a pre-industrial climate, we wouldn't expect to see heat waves of this intensity at all.
Compounding the heat, people fasting for Ramadan. Kizwensida Gigma is a climate scientist in Burkina Faso.
In the Sahel, many people are Muslims, and as a result, they were not able to use the regular cooling options. More people were therefore more exposed to the extreme heat and would not have enough capacity to cool themselves down.
And contributing to the heat wave, the unprecedented ocean temperatures the world is seeing. Wasila Chow is with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
The ocean has warmed tremendously, especially the Gulf of Guinea and the tropical North Atlantic are extremely warm right now. If the ocean temperatures were not as elevated as they are, probably would not have seen as excessive temperatures that we see right now.
Extreme enough to kill. One hospital in Mali said in just a few days the heat killed more than 100 people, what they'd usually see in a month. Deadly consequences in a part of the world, says Gigma, disproportionately feeling the burden.
The parts of Africa which are impacted at the moment are contributing close to nothing to the actual emissions, meaning that they're basically experiencing the consequences of the deeds of other people elsewhere.
He's calling on the international community for help, especially as this hot season is likely to continue until June. But well beyond that, as humans barrel towards a world 2 degrees or warmer than pre-industrial levels, scientists estimate this part of Africa, which usually experiences extreme temperatures like this every 2 centuries, will instead feel it every 20 years. Anand Ram, CBC News, Toronto.
Politicians of all stripes often cite carbon capture as a way to control greenhouse gas emissions. And in a few short weeks, the fans turn on at a new plant in Iceland. It will be the world's most advanced project to suck the carbon out of the air and bury it deep underground at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. But critics say it doesn't live up to the hype. Ben Shingler has more.
This promotional video is meant to inspire hope that the world's most advanced project to suck carbon out of the air is ready. Mammoth, a facility in the shadow of Iceland's mountains.
We're now scaling by an order of magnitude to Mammoth.
A new milestone, but still far from what's needed to make a real reduction in the level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Daniel Nathan is with Climeworks, the company behind the project.
The fact of life is the technology only happens when you build something. You only learn from building. You only scale from building.
And more building is planned. The technology is drawing hundreds of millions of dollars in investments around the world. Quebec-based Deep Sky thinks Canada can lead the way in developing the technology. Damien Steele is the company's CEO.
What Saudi Arabia is to the oil and gas industry, Canada could be to carbon removal.
The company has secured $75 million in financing and plans to test nearly a dozen direct air capture systems. It's an energy-intensive process, and Quebec's cheap, clean power is a big draw.
And so what we need to do is we need to help these companies figure out how to scale manufacturing, how to do it in an energy-efficient way, and how to mass produce these things.
Ottawa has billions in tax credits for such projects.
Businesses to invest in emerging clean technologies.
Critics worry direct air capture misses the point, that we need to drastically reduce emissions in the first place. And this technology does far too little for far too much money.
We haven't decided which emissions are okay to continue for a little bit longer.
Holly Buck is an assistant professor of environment and sustainability at University at Buffalo in New York. She says the idea is to capture emissions from sectors where they are difficult to avoid, like the manufacturing of concrete, and make big cutbacks elsewhere.
And without that, you can imagine you're wasting all of your carbon removal capacity on something like private jets, which might be a luxury emission, not a truly necessary, hard to abate emission.
To capture CO2 from flue gas and concentrate it so that it can be...
Fans spinning and wires everywhere. Naoko Ellis's lab at UBC is more than a pipe dream. She studies direct air capture and says the technology can be part of the solution.
As we move forward with decarbonization and decarbonizing Canada's industry, we're going to need this technology in a variety of places.
But it will take time.
Imagine you're climbing Mount Everest. You're not climbing it at one go.
Even for Climeworks' new facility, what the world emits in an entire year, Mammoth will only capture about half a minute's worth. Ben Chingler, CBC News, Montreal.
American rock and roll musician Dickie Betts has died. Betts was a founding member of the Allman Brothers Band. He wrote and sang their biggest hit, 1973's Ramblin' Man. Built on Betts' guitar work, the band's pioneering sound fused country, blues, 60s rock, and jazz. Betts' song Jessica, written for his daughter, became a rock radio staple despite having no lyrics and running 7.5 minutes. The Allman Brothers broke other stereotypes, too. A biracial group from the Deep South. Born in Florida, Dickie Betts grew up near the highway he sings about in Ramblin' Man. And in a statement, his family says he died peacefully today after a battle with cancer, surrounded by loved ones, at home in Osprey, Florida, just off that highway. Dickie Betts was 80 years old. Thanks for being with us. This has been Your World Tonight for April 18th. I'm Susan Bonner. Talk to you again.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.